Hello, this is Maybe a Girl, and you're listening to The Tony Soto Show.
And I am Tony Soto, Maybe a Girl. Thank you so much for that fabulous introduction, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It is great to be back.
Girl, how long has it been?
Two, 3 years.
Were you a councilwoman the last time
you
were?
You know, actually, I think I was running for neighborhood council. That's so right. It actually had to be 5 years ago.
That's right. That's right. Wow. That's right. And you were reelected, right?
Twice
now.
Yes.
How's that going?
It's great. You could hear the hesitancy in my voice. It's great.
Yeah, I love that pause.
It's a little bit of, it's great, and it's also everything you think it would be. It has been such a joy serving my community. I am a huge fan of hyper-local politics. I mm-hmm. think that is where you can make the biggest difference, not only in your life, but the lives of your roommates, your family members, your neighbors, your direct community. But there's also so many limitations when it comes to local governments, as opposed to something like federal governments.
Yeah.
So it's been wonderful. I've been able to do a lot of great things neighborhood-wise and influence a lot of city legislation. But again, it has its limitations. And for me, it's been interesting because I'm the most tenured person on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council.
Really?
Now. We have 21 board members. I've been there the longest now.
Wow.
And, you know, in many ways, it's an honor and a responsibility because a lot of people look to me for, well, what do we do in this situation? What do we do in that situation? What's it been like historically? What's the tradition here? And when I started, it was a very progressive neighborhood council. I ran on a slate called Silver Lake Progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful because all 11 of us got elected to the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council. And with it being a 21-member board, we effectively created a progressive
majority. Nice.
Which is so rare in any political scene. But now that I'm serving in my third term, I...
Did we lose a few on the way?
I think we lost a few, and I don't want to crap on my neighborhood council in any regard, because I work with a lot of wonderful people, but I think I'm working with maybe just not as many progressives as I would like to. I think that...
What is the... What? Because as a progressive, mm-hmm. I always wonder this. What is the distaste for helping? On the conservative side, what is it about the progressive platform that makes conservatives and even centrists not be on board?
I think the big thing is, and this goes from everything from a neighborhood council to a city council to state reps to federal reps. I think when you are somebody who is comfortable in your situation, your personal situation, when you are able to comfortably afford living,
mm-hmm.
You have less, maybe not less concern, but less idea of how many other people are struggling.
This is why poor people need to be in a position mm-hmm. of power and election and elected, because I've been thinking loosely about either hightailing it out of here or running for some kind of local office and use my campaign strategy as I'm poor too.
Yep.
I'm just as poor. And here's the thing about poor folks. We can survive. I've been poor my whole life. I've made it this far. I'm 44 years old. What happened when people lost money after Wall Street crashed or whatever? They killed themselves. The rich kill themselves when they go broke. Broke people just keep on living.
They can't handle it.
So they need to be in charge.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I'm a working class person. I'm a renter. I've lived in the same apartment in Silver Lake. But here's the thing. The neighborhood, it was relatively affordable when I moved in over a decade ago. And as somebody who is a queer person, working class, renter, I don't have health care insurance. I'm barely able to stay in this apartment. And that's the thing is when you are struggling to figure out how you're going to survive, it is perhaps running for office is maybe not the first thing in your mind because your priorities
sure.
are how
Hunger.
Am I going to survive? Yeah. And even being on the neighborhood council, that even actually contributes to my struggles in many ways because of the fact that it's a volunteer position. I don't get paid to be on the neighborhood council. I don't get paid to work for and serve the city and everybody that lives here.
You don't?
No.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Really.
First of all, I thought you were making some kind of money doing that.
Nope. In fact, because I don't drive and I have to take lifts to my meetings and back, I'm losing money on the deal.
Honey, as a drag queen who don't drive, it's an Uber every time. It's an Uber. You know, but I'm actually impressed by you maybe because I did the unhoused count
mm-hmm.
this year.
Yep.
Last year. This year?
This year.
And we did the Silver Lake area, and we all met at the church, and I saw you walk in. And I mean, just watching you like command the room and like, you know, just so like respectful and like there for and present. I mean, it's just, it's impressive. And now knowing that you don't fucking make any money doing it, I kind of want to hit you.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the thing. It really is community work. And I don't think that's, I don't like the idea of being paid for community work. And in fact, I think it lessens it to a degree. But the fact that I am a sitting member of this council, which is a part of LA city government. And when you think about how we are giving more than $3 billion every single year to police, yet we cannot afford to give even a humble stipend to our neighborhood council members that are actually doing the work.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive in because it is a political year. You just had an unsuccessful run for Congress.
I did.
For Schiff's vacant seat.
Correct.
The state of the world. Like, let's start on cops because you mentioned cops. Why is the Georgia cop city the only cop city we're hearing about when there's one that's opening up here in California and there's ones that are opening up in multiple different states?
Yep. It's so funny you brought that up. Like, I was, as soon as you started talking about that, I immediately thought cop city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's wild. And I, first of all, I don't know why anybody believes that our municipal police need to be military trained.
Yeah.
And often being trained by, you know, some, not just big military forces, but, you know, the IDF has trained with the U.S. military and with local cop municipalities. And, you know, I truly believe that, you know, there is, I think this idea that there's unrest right now. There's mm-hmm. political unrest. There's civil and social unrest. And people are wising up. People are starting to realize, wow, we're all kind of being fucked over by the ruling class. And I think people are starting to really say enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think we have these cop cities developing is because cops in the, again, the ruling class want to be prepared for a civil uprising, which I think truthfully is inevitable given the state of current affairs, from everything between, you know, just housing, healthcare, education. People are really, really struggling, and yet they are working their asses off day in, day out for crumbs.
But do you think that, like, because, you know, you hear all the time, this is such a divisive country, we're all so divided, why can't we rally on our poverty? Like, when there's so few billionaires and maybe more millionaires, but like, when there's so few of them and so many of us, why is it that why can't we just like get behind our poverty and fight for each other? Because if we are living comfortably, then we can tackle on all the other reasons why we don't like each other.
Absolutely. You know, I think when we often divide politics between left and right, between blue and red, but the fact of the matter is there are so many underlying similarities between people on both the left and right, the red and the blue, the GOP and the Democrats, on a class line.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people support Medicare for all or some form of single payer universal health care. And that crosses both party lines. But the parties themselves work so hard to convince everybody that it's the other person who's the enemy. It's the other side that's the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, when it comes to the Republican Party itself, yeah, that's my enemy, especially in terms of the kinds of legislation that they're putting forward. But they're duping their own supporters into thinking that Democrats are out to get them.
Yeah.
And vice versa. You know, I'm very against this idea of the duopoly, and the duopoly is supported by, once again, the ruling class on either side. So you have rich people on the left, rich people on the right. And I don't even like saying left because, you know, a lot of these, you know, oligarchs on the left, they're not really true.
Yeah, they're poser progressives. Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, if you were to have a class uprising where all of the poor people who are struggling to survive, again, in terms of housing, healthcare, and education, that's scary to the ruling class in terms of numbers.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And that's why you see the influx of and that's also why, if you know, you're like, the things that the IOF are doing to Gazans look pretty familiar to things that are starting to happen to like our protesters and stuff here.
Absolutely.
It's all, you know, connected. Now, you ran for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It was a weird year. We had a vacant seat. someone died, so everyone was trying to race for that seat. What, first of all, how was campaigning during this time? Because I feel like it was probably a little more ruthless.
It was more ruthless, but it was also, it's so interesting because, again, this was my third time running for Congress. I ran in 2020, 2022, and now 2024. When I ran in 2020, we did so much better than anybody expected us to do. I came in third place out of eight candidates. I lost the second place slot, which would have advanced me to the general election, by less than 1%. I received over 20,000 votes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought that was remarkable. We came so close. We said we have to do this again in 2022. I ended up coming in second place out of nine. I moved on to the general election in 2022. Granted, we didn't win, but I was up against such immense money and power. You know, Adam Schiff, who I ran against, a lot of people, you know, back then and even to this day are shocked that I had the audacity and the gall to run against Adam Schiff, because a lot of people think he's progressive.
It's pretty respectable of you to do it, honestly.
Thank you.
Yeah, because, but he's a warmongering,
he's
fucking
a warmonger.
Conservative.
Exactly. He's a warmonger. Yeah. He takes so much dirty corporate money, but he'll turn around and say, you know, some of the right things that make you think that he's actually a progressive. But his, and I will say this, as an elected official, you were only as good as your voting record. I stand by every single vote in my voting record, even on this local level. I guarantee you, if you were to look into Adam Schiff's voting record, you would not think that he is the progressive that he is made out to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up, I think I got about 30% of the votes in the general election in 2022. And then, just a few months later, I was still coming down from the 2022 election when Dianne Feinstein died.
Yeah.
And, you know, this sort of created this cascading effect of political shifts with a T, not shifts with an FF, throughout California. And, you know, it was already rumored that some people were thinking about challenging her because,
she was a ghost at the end. Yeah, a zombie. Know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know.
And that's no disrespect. She was a zombie that did a lot of great things, but she was a zombie that stayed on way too fucking long.
Exactly.
She fucked us just like Ruth.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Like, I respect what you have done, but
but you need to know when to say bye.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I saw that she had died, I knew immediately that he was going to be running for that seat. I think Katie Porter had already announced that she was running to challenge Dianne.
Mm-hmm.
So there was already going to be a big challenge, you know, whether or not Dianne had died. But when she died, and then I saw that Schiff very shortly thereafter announced that he was running for her seats. And then Barbara Lee announced that she was running.
Who I voted for.
That's who I voted for as well. Barbara Lee. I knew it was going to be. So you think about that, but then you have to think about, here we have three Democratic Congress people in U.S. Congress in the state of California who are now all vying for U.S. Senate. So that opens up three seats down below.
Puts us in danger.
And then at that point, now you have people running for those seats. So you had state assembly members, state senators, and other people in political positions now running for something higher. So I mentioned this on my way in, that as soon as Dianne died and it turned into an open seat when Adam Schiff announced that he was running for U.S. Senate instead of his U.S. House seat, which is what I had been running for, all of these career politicians came slithering out from underneath their rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Now's my time. Everyone said, now's my time. Well, you know, I had been putting in the work for this district for 5 years now.
Well, let me ask you this, maybe. We are in the midst of one of the most dysfunctional Congresses that we've had in history. They haven't done anything except for try to impeach for revenge for the orange menace. What could you have brought? What do you feel like you could have brought to Congress to get the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Lauren Boberts and all those fucking losers to either lessen their light or get them on board? What do you think you could have done?
Here's the thing. I don't know if anything I or anybody else could say will necessarily pull them over, but I think it was more so about showing that anybody and everybody, and especially people like us, should be not just involved in politics, but should actually be representatives. So for me, what I wanted to bring to the table was a variety of things. First of all, somebody who is corporate free, takes no dirty money, and really just wants to see things like universal health care, housing for all, guaranteed tuition-free college, environmental justice. I think also as a transgender person, somebody who's trans non-binary, there has never been a federal person who has been elected who is transgender. And granted, we are starting to see trans people being elected to state houses, state governments. There's been some appointments, but we've never seen a federally elected transgender person. And given that trans people have seen so many anti-trans bills being introduced all across the nation over the past few years, I mean, even within the first week of this year, 2024, there was, I think, 175 anti-trans bills. So for me, it was about bringing a voice to our federal government that has never been listened to on that sort of level. Mm-hmm. And whether or not I would have had the ability to change minds on the right, I don't think that's the case. But, you know, my hope was that I would inspire other people to join this coalition of leftist progressives, people who are socially minded, people who want to see universal rights and human rights for everybody, regardless. And so that's really what I was hoping to bring. And I think that's something that I offer that all of the other candidates did not offer.
Mm. So, well, it's okay. So it's one thing to talk about conservatives and the people who you're going to be voting alongside. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to talk about lobbies. Let's talk about lobbies, because that's the thing about once you get into Congress, once you get into the Senate, once you like get into that, like you're gonna have money thrown at you. How would Congressperson maybe avoid that kind of like, because cha-ching, cha-ching.
Hello.
Looks cute. And like, remember, we can't forget Marjorie Taylor Greene's Cruella de Vil fox fur jacket that she got at the first State of the Union for fucking Biden. It was yep. Like, oh, you're cashing checks, girl. You can tell. How would you stay away from that?
You know, for me, I wanted my voters to trust that that's exactly how I would go into it. Not like Marjorie Taylor Greene, but
Fox fur.
It would all be faux fur for me. But I think, you know, I've taken a corporate free pledge since the beginning of my run. And that pledge is to not accept any sort of corporate PAC money and to not accept any sort of lobbyist money, because I do not want to be influenced by money. And I firmly believe that voters across the board, whether you're left or right, red or blue, also want their representatives to be representatives of the people, not representatives of corporate America.
Our government made corporate America human, though. You know what I mean? Corporations are considered human in this government.
Technically, so, at this point.
So, like, know, how? So the thing is like, this is the way I look at it. I'm like, I feel like the government's kind of like, we're taking care of people because corporations are people now.
Yeah.
Like, this year's going to be crazy. It's Joe Biden, Donald Trump, once again, two old people that we don't want, nobody wants, but yet the RNC and the DNC do not know how to work for the people. It's going to be the same mudslinging, but they're much older now, and it's a little sadder.
Yeah, it's sad.
Yeah, it's sad to watch two fucking corpses fight.
Yeah.
What is your message, though, to the American people? Because at this point, first of all, we know this country gets fatigued about anything. If something lasts longer than 2 weeks, we're tired. We don't want to talk about it. But, like, what do you tell the people like me who wake up and, like, feel like you're in a cuckoo clock? Because, like, to me, being a progressive makes sense. Like, the people who are voting Republican are not rich people. These are not rich people. But they're just as disenfranchised as we are. Like, what do you tell even the fucking conservative voter or the conservative non-voter? What do you tell them if they are disillusioned by this whole process?
Well, first of all, I want to ask, do you think we have a lot of conservatives listening to the Tony Soto show?
I think that I do think that I have some conservative people because I do get plenty of hateful email. And this is my fun podcast. This is not the podcast that I talk about politics on. So
totally. So I think that, you know, when I think about my run, you know, I'm disappointed that I lost. I would be lying if I said that I wasn't disappointed, especially because for me, it was not just this one election, but the culmination of 5 years of trying to run for this seat. And I think why I'm also really disappointed is I feel like my campaign and my candidacy provided a lot of hope, especially for people in parts of the nation where you don't see any sort of queer representation, not just on a political level, but just in everyday society. And so I feel like I let people down. And I know that's not really true. I know
you,
that that's
I
not
know you
true.
Might, you feel like that, though. You can't help
it's
but
hard
feel like
not
that.
To yeah. feel that way. But what I really want to show is that my campaign, and I try not to focus this on my campaign, but my campaign, I think, provided a lot of hope for people and a lot of it showed people that you don't have to be this wealthy cis het white old man to be able to run for politics. And when we think about what a politician looks like, for many of us, that's what pops up into our mind, these like old suits.
Yeah. Don't forget, this bitch debated Schiff.
I debated
Schiff. All right. She debated Schiff. Like, that's major. He's been around for a long fucking time.
And he, if you watch the video, he turned so pink.
Oh, yeah, girl. Like,
he turned pink. He was no longer a white man. He was a pink man. And so he, for me, part of my candidacy was always about inspiring others to run and to show that everyday people, not only can we, but should we be doing this? Yeah. And that's the fact is when our system is not looking out for us, we have to be the ones to look out for us.
Right.
And we have power in numbers. And so I hope that other queer people, other trans people, other poor people run for office. And even though it doesn't happen every time, even though this was technically an L, it was a win in many, many ways.
But what about money and campaigns? Like, that's the thing. Poor people are looking at this, and all you hear about on like these major campaigns is, oh, well, you know, Trump has no money. Biden has $100+ million for his campaign.
Well, it's
like,
so,
like, what do you tell to poor people when it's like, hey, yeah, you should run? It's like, yeah, but that costs fucking money.
Well, you know, and I don't think, I wouldn't recommend that, you know, an everyday person just suddenly decide to run for president. And that's why you have to start at these, you know, lower local levels, which again, there is no shame or discredit in that, because again, that's where you're making the biggest difference for you and your direct community. And so I think that people should be doing this regardless of whether or not you have money. And I think it really points to the fact that we need to get big money out of politics. In review of my campaign, you know, it's funny because when I ran last in 2022, and I made it to the general election, we only had raised about $33,000, $34,000.
Wow.
And we were up against $15 million.
Yeah.
This election cycle, it's so funny because we raised more than three times the amount. We raised, I think, over $110,000.
Congrats.
Which, thank you.
Awesome.
And
really
I will say,
good.
And it's entirely grassroots, people funded. Yeah. I had people, and it's funny, when you get a donation, it will tell you, because they have to list, you know, their name, where they're from, and their occupation. I was having people who were cashiers at Walmart donating to my campaign. Mm. And that made me feel like I have to be doing, this is who I'm doing this for, is for these people who
if you got someone from a Walmart's attention.
They are, they were, and not executive Walmart, a lower level.
The employees,
you know,
of Walmart, yeah.
And so I can only imagine, like, I'm struggling. Everybody's struggling. And when you have poor people donating to your campaign, you feel all that much more dedicated to have to win this fight. And I think that's why I ultimately was so disappointed. But anyways, I'm drifting off a little bit. I think here's the thing. You can win an election. You can at least get attention without raising a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. You know, our funding was all grassroots funded, and we actually had donors in all 50 states.
If your message is good, people will be receptive.
If your message is good. And here's the thing. You look at all of the career politicians that I ran against, and it was just, it's the same old messaging that we have been hearing. Blue good, red bad. And it's a lot of like coded language as well. Mm-hmm. It's you know, they'll talk about healthcare, but they'll talk about access to healthcare, but they won't talk about universal healthcare.
Yeah.
They'll talk about you know, ending homelessness, but they won't talk about giving housing to people. And so it's this coded language where it's like it sounds good, but you're not actually offering solutions.
Let's talk about the unhoused situation here in Los Angeles real quick, because I'm not 100% like not convinced that we have other states like bringing in the last 10 years, the number of homeless people, the unhoused people in this town is staggering.
Mm-hmm.
They just Prop 1, I think, might pass. I know it's very, very close, but voters are reluctant to keep fucking voting on propositions for unhoused when we're like, what's this money going to? Like, what is a solution for you to like help with the unhoused situation here in Los Angeles?
Totally. You know, and that's a question that I've been asked over and over and over again. And I will say it's not an easy answer to answer in an elevator pitch, if you will. And I think a lot of people are looking for this one like thorough line solution, and it has to be a multifaceted approach. And so when I think about it, I think about the cycle of homelessness, not just, okay, I'm looking at this person who is experiencing homelessness right now, but you think about the cycle. And my work with working with unhoused people began when I was living in Chicago. I volunteered for the Lincoln Park Community Shelter, and I was an overnight supervisor. And one of the things that struck me when I was working there as an overnight volunteer was that, you know, we have this sort of idea, this sort of stereotype, this sort of trope of what an unhoused person looks like. And when I worked with this community in Chicago, the thing that immediately struck me was that, they look just like you and me, and they act just like you and me because you know
some
what?
Are,
because
some are they're students, human beings. Some are students.
Exactly.
Some work.
Exactly.
Like there are people with jobs that are, it's like.
And so in a place like LA where we have, you know, this massive homelessness crisis and housing crisis, so many people are putting the blame on the people who are living on the streets when in reality, these are policy positions. And even the way that the city of Los Angeles handles homelessness, in my opinion, is completely inhumane.
It's sickening.
You might be familiar with a policy known as 4118, which is the sit, lie, sleep law. And it basically prohibits you from sitting, lying, or sleeping within 500 feet of schools, parks, freeway underpasses. But then it also creates these entire zones throughout the city where you cannot pitch a tent. And in my opinion, it's not even my opinion, this is what I believe to be why that was put into place. There was a Ninth Circuit Court of Appellate's ruling a few years ago. It was known as Boise versus Martin. And that was Boise, Idaho. And basically, this group, they sued Boise, Idaho, because Boise was trying to outlaw encampments in their city. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals determined that that was unconstitutional based on the idea of cruel and unusual punishment, that you cannot criminalize people and send them to jail because they are living on the streets when there is not enough homeless shelters in the city to accommodate them. And so we here in Los Angeles fall under the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So LA, from a constitutional point of view, cannot outlaw homelessness citywide. They cannot outlaw encampments. But what they can do is, as a loophole, they can create these special zones.
To make it harder for people to find places to sleep. To make it harder for people to find a place to sleep.
And to criminalize them.
That's the craziness of the whole situation. You know, I tell people, because people, you know, sometimes they come for me and they're like, well, what do you think we should do? And I was like, I don't think it's what we should do. I think it's what we should undo. What we should undo was everything that Reagan did, where he cut social programs. Let's not forget that's where it started. Like, if we had the same social programs that we had pre-Reagan, I don't know that we would be in the situation that we are in today. But Republicans paint him like he's some god. Mm-hmm. Maybe a girl, politically. What's next for you? Because I would hate to think, I would hate to think that a third loss for Congress would silence you.
Thank you. And it is not going to silence me. I put out my concession statement a few weeks ago, and I, you know, thanked my supporters and said, you know, I'm probably going to lay low for a little bit because I do need a break. And I felt like I was starting to burn out a little bit towards the end of the campaign as somebody who is working, trying to pay my rent, not being paid for my local position, not being paid to run for Congress. I'm taking care of myself right now. But that is not to imply that I'm not going to be running for something in the future. In all likelihood, I probably will not run for this particular seat again.
Why not city council?
Well, I will say I've got my eye on a couple of seats.
Yeah. There's a good number of seats that could be a little boot to the butt, if you ask me. Well, let's talk about drag, because you've been very busy campaigning. You, first of all, found out you don't get paid. I'm shocked by that. I don't know how you're making ends meet. Tell me how your drag career has been in between this, because for me, it's been rocky and I'm not running for office. How has it been for you?
You know, it's been rocky as well. And when we had kind of talked about this a little bit before about how things kind of changed after the pandemic. And, you know, before the pandemic, I was doing maybe like four or five gigs a week, you know, and that in and of itself is exhausting. But afterwards, you know, even with when you're running for a higher office, you put a lot of time into that. And so I made the personal decision to set aside some of my drag endeavors to continue to run for office. But I also have always felt that my visibility as a drag performer, as a drag queen, and as a trans person has been so important and fundamental to my overall message. So I basically what I did was, you know, I host and produce a monthly drag brunch, or a weekly drag brunch. I cut it down to 2 weeks a month. So that was really just so that I could have 2 days off every month.
Yeah, sometimes you need them. Yeah.
But, you know, I was really using drag to help campaign. And I think one of the cool things about being a drag host is that you've got a microphone in front of an audience and they're going to listen to you whether or not, you know, whatever you're going to say.
Oh, girl, I did your brunch a couple times and you're like, hey, do you want health care for all?
Exactly. And, you know what? These are the things I want to see at a drag show. And, you know, the number of conversations that has opened up for me with people, you know, people who are coming to my brunch for the first time. And then afterwards, we're talking about politics. And I think drag and politics, they seem like such an unlikely couple, but they're actually such a likely couple because
politics
of, you know,
and gay bars alone should be the norm.
They should be
political
hubs.
We should have never stopped being political. We've gotten comfortable.
I think especially, you know, when gay marriage came about in the mid-2010s, I think
which wasn't
were
my
like,
fight. Didn't fight for it.
Yeah, they were just kind of like, okay, we're here. We're, you know, all right, we're good now. Yeah. But, you know, we're seeing an active attempt to roll back on our rights. And that's why these conversations are so important and critical right now because, you know, when I think about things like, you know, Roe v. Wade being overturned and nobody thought that was going to happen and nobody did anything about it. And then it was overturned and we saw a few weeks of protesting and now we're just living in this sort of dystopic after effect.
Yeah, now women are just
now
dying.
What?
Yeah.
We have to be actively fighting to keep our rights. They're not just guaranteed for the rest of our lives because we suddenly have them.
No, and this is the thing too. Like, I don't know who I have to like remind, but things were so much better pre 9/11. Let's not forget the Patriot Act took a lot of our shit.
Yes.
And once they realized how easily we turned over during that, they were just like, let's just keep chipping away.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
Well, listen, maybe just three more things. Just three more things.
Let's hear it.
Let me see here. There's a couple questions I compiled. All right, maybe. Now, in our discussion with loss, let's talk about tangible loss, things you can. Airlines have lost planes recently. Atlantis lost a whole city. The Royals lost a fucking princess. Besides a Congress run, what else have you lost?
Oh, what else have I lost? Oh my goodness. I have lost respect for people who have power and who have influence who do not use it to help others.
There you go. And that is fucking tea. Because I don't understand. Like, I just don't get when you have so much, what is the problem with ticking off just a little bit? Like, just passing on a little bit to somebody. Like, so do you, so in your time running and like being so involved in the city, do you have someone that works around you that you might have had a different notion about? You're like, oh, this person might not be a good person for this city, but then they turned out to be someone that you like work with and that you respect?
Yes and no. I actually almost have it a little bit more in a reverse situation where I was working with some good people and I thought I was supporting some good people until I saw the way that they responded to certain things or their actions on or the way they vote on certain
things.
Did they
say, per my last email?
Per my last email. And that's really disappointing. And I think that's also why we should not be idolizing politicians. And that's coming from a politician. We should not be idolizing our heroes.
Would you ever think that you would be saying you're a politician? I've known you for a while, girl. I've known you since Chicago. Would you?
No, never. Actually, I shouldn't say never. But I think it just feeds into that idea of that I never thought that I could.
Do I remember
and so I never
you?
Thought that I would.
Do I remember you in Chicago, like scantily clad, doing a tour one day, like at the lakefront or something, like walking around in like little underwear, giving a fucking tour.
You know.
And now look at her. She's a politician.
That actually happened here.
Oh, was that here?
That was here. I was giving Speedo tours for a while. Right. Well, I did architecture and historical tours in Chicago.
Me too.
And that's what brought me here.
I did those too. The
How
boat
fine.
Tour and stuff.
The
I,
boat tour.
Yeah, and I did all the historic theater tours.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's see. Thousands of young Gen X and old millennials are finding out their youth was mired in problematic children's television with the release of the show Quiet on Set. When did you know that everything was a lie?
First of all, did you say young Gen X?
Yeah.
No. Okay.
I'm considered a young Gen Xer.
Got it.
Because I was born in 79.
I'm an old millennial.
And you're an old millennial. Yes.
You know, I actually watched that documentary last night.
I don't have any of the streaming services because I'm so brave for boycotting. However, I've been watching it on the TikTok and
I think it's hard to say because I think we always sort of idealize the past as future struggles become more and more apparent. We tend to idealize the past. And I think the 90s are an era that a lot of people idealize. And it makes me wonder, is it going to be sort of the same effect as boomers idealizing, you know, post-World War II? Is it going to be like that? Is that something we're going to look back on and cringe?
Like maybe opium wasn't a great idea.
Because I think, you know, the 90s were relatively, compared to now, a better time.
So fun.
But also, did we just have less things to worry about as like youth?
We just weren't connected. Like that's the thing. Like I mean, I just remember being young and like not talking to someone the whole day and just having a great time playing in the yard. You know what I mean? It's like shit like that. But it's just like it's with the release of this. And I saw a documentary recently about Ren and Stimpy and like how mired the creator of that was and like pedophilia and shit.
Oh, God.
Like it's just like. Were we all in serious danger and we just didn't fucking know it? I mean, I wanted to be a child star so bad when I was young. You know what I mean? And honestly, I'm from poor parents. I can't, no offense, parents, but I can't say that they wouldn't have like looked the other way in hopes that I keep my fucking job. You know what I mean?
Totally.
It's like wild.
Totally. And I think that's probably one of the great things about the rise of the internet is it's really hard to keep things like that covered up and hush hush these days. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of these exposés on the 90s, because the internet didn't have the effect or the widespread reach that it does today, especially with social media, that we're seeing a lot of survivors and people who have been impacted by these things speak out. And it's never too late to do that. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it shows that maybe the 90s weren't as great for everybody as we thought they were.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing was, it's like, I am the Nickelodeon generation.
Same.
Like,
same.
I remember when it started as that fucking pinwheel thing bullshit. Like, I was there from the get. And quite frankly, like, I mean, I aged out around all that, so I don't really know the Amanda Bynes and all that stuff.
But
like,
I also, same,
but
similar.
But you can't do that on television and all that shit. Like, I was there, and you know, I've actually done a couple of drag things with Nickelodeon here.
Same. I have too. I love Nickelodeon.
They're very kind, you know? They pay very well. Thank you, Nickelodeon.
Oh, I thought you... So you actually have done things with Nickelodeon.
Yeah,
I've done like Nickelodeon like parodies and stuff like
no,
that.
No, I hosted their their holiday parties in their Glendale
office.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, like the thing is this was not a documentary that I was hoping for, but I always knew Dan Schneider was weird since head of the class.
Totally.
All right, final question. Wild bees recently held up a tennis match and stung many people. How do you get rid of an unwelcomed guest?
Oh, you know, it's so funny. I'm hard at doing that because I tend to be a diplomatic and cordial person. And it's hard for me to just say, I don't want to be talking to you anymore. My friend Rory, who I had mentioned to you, my friend Rory gave me this great line to use. And it works at if you're at a political function, it works if you're at a party, if you're at a bar and someone is just, you know, yapping your ear off and you just like you want to get out of the situation. What you do is you look them right in the eye, you lean in and you say, "Good evening, have a wonderful night." And then you walk away. And there's really no way to like you sort of stun them. They think about it, but you're already 10 feet
gone.
Away by that point.
You're gone. You're gone. Maeve, it was so good having you back on the Tony Soto Show. Did you have a good time?
I had such a great time, Tony.
Why don't you tell us where we can find you on the social medias, and if you have any gigs you want to plug, now is the time.
Absolutely. So you can find me on Instagram at Maeveagirl. That's Maeveagirl. I am on Twitter, now known as something else. Our website is still active, maeveagirlforcongress.org, if you want to find out more about what I was fighting for. And we also have I'm doing a show at the Lyric Hyperion. It is Star Wars, the deleted scenes, definitely unauthorized, May 3rd and May 4th at the Lyric Hyperion, and I hope y'all will come out.
Shout out to Lyric. You know, I like the Lyric. They're a good little establishment. Well, thank you again for coming on. Now, listeners, if you like me, remember you can catch me every Friday at 33 Taps this month. I host Bingo and Drag Race starting at 7 p.m., and I am Tony Soto Productions on anything I'm doing in drag on Instagram. And if you just want to see a Gen Xer trying to stay relevant on the internet, I am the Tony Soto Show on Instagram and TikTok. Until next week, goodbye.
Oh, Tony. Oh. Tony, can I say one more thing?
Of course you can.
Good evening. Have a wonderful night.
Goodbye.